You like Fireboy? I do.
You're listening to Your Tables on Fire, a weekly conversation with the hottest game designers on Kickstarter. Here comes your host, Jeff Beck.
Thanks for tuning in to Your Tables on Fire. I'm your host, Jeff Beck, and this is episode number 24. This episode is brought to you by Word Domination, the upcoming game from Uproarious Games. If you love word games, or strategy games, or both, check out Word Domination at www.worddomination.net. With me today, we have a very special guest. This is Alex Cheng, the founder of Cardboard Dynamo and the lead designer of Giga Robo. Alex, welcome to Your Tables on Fire.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Glad we can make this work.
Yeah.
Alex, take a minute and introduce yourself for us.
So I'm Alex Cheng. I'm a Chicago native. I got into game design starting with Giga Robo. It's my first game that I'm moving to try to get published. We started development about 3 years ago, and it's just been kind of a completely eye-opening experience. And it's, yeah.
yeah, I'm sure. Now, what about your history with games in general? How did you get into gaming? You know, have you always been a gamer since you were little?
In terms of being really invested in the hobby, it happened relatively recently. The way I first got started was because when I was a kid, my mom got me and my brother HeroQuest. And that was like the first time we were ever able to experience like the hobby side of board gaming rather than, you know, roll and move games like Monopoly and things like that. And so when we were kids, what happened was that, so she gave us this box and it's an incredible experience if you've ever, like, as a kid opening that up and you see all the miniatures and you see all the diorama pieces and all the set pieces, and it's just immediately it activates your imagination. But the problem was that we were so young, we had nobody to show us how to play it. I had no idea what it was, and we never really ever truly played the game. We would just set up dungeons and kind of like play with the miniatures, and that was it. And then when I was late in college, I had a couple friends who invited me over to play games kind of for the first time, and the game they wanted to play was HeroQuest, and it was just a completely extreme like nostalgia trip. And I was like, I know this. And then, like, you know, all these old senses started firing. And then, so we did like a HeroQuest campaign, and then that completely snowballed like more and more and more. That led me to asking like, oh, so what's next? And then I found out about Descent. Then we were playing through Descent, and then I was like, what's next? And then they were saying, well, the next step is really Dungeons and Dragons. And I was like, we should do that. This is the thing we should do. And then we did that, and then I immediately wanted to run my own campaign, and then I did that for a while, and then that kind of led me to this point. It was like, well, where do we go from here? Where I was kind of fully engaged with the creative side of gaming. And then at that point, I was just like, I want to make a game. And also, by the time we had started playing Dungeons and Dragons, I had gone a really great education just on the world of tabletop at that point, finding out what was really out there and the depth, and also just kind of discovering how tabletop gaming was providing these, you know, wonderful social dynamics and experiences between people. And there's something that just clicked at that moment, and I really wanted to dive in. And I've been a fan of video games and video game design for most of my life, and really the main reason I haven't been into tabletop gaming for longer was just a lack of exposure. I have to say, I'm pretty happy that the way I dove in was through like HeroQuest and Descent and D&D, because I kind of felt like in many ways I jumped into the deep end of the pool. So that's pretty much my history with it, except for the terrible roll and move games I designed when I was 5 years old, where every third square you'd just die. But yeah.
Those are fun too. Come on.
They are. That's like really the brick and mortar of my designs.
So, in your opinion, like, what do you look for in a game when you're pulling a game off a shelf? What catches your eye?
For me, I think I look for. It's interesting because I don't always necessarily look for the kind of games I'd want to design. I think the first thing I do look at is theme, though I'm not a fan of the kind of the divides that there are right now between like Is it thematic? Is it, you know, purely mechanical? Is it an abstract? And like, I'm especially not a big fan of like the divide between Euro and like, you know, Ameritrash, or if you want to call it Amerithrash.
Right.
I very much want a game. I feel like games should just be games. They should exist unto their own. Each game should kind of define itself and it's the space it inhabits. But sorry, that was a complete tangent. When I'm looking for a game, I think I do look for theme first, though. I am really just attracted by things that I find immersive or things that kind of allow me to experience like a genre or a setting that I'm not able to experience through other mediums, which is one of the reasons I think tabletop games are so incredible, is because, I mean, people might make jokes about trading in the Mediterranean games, but it's kind of incredible that that's somehow a saturated topic, like in the genre. Like, that's so bonkers to me. But I love that. And it's, there's so many different spaces you can inhabit and so many different worlds you can inhabit so easily. So I think theme first, and then I kind of work backwards from there. Mm-hmm. And I just look for games that, so does it have a theme I'm really attracted to? And then do the mechanics of that game really justify the theme, or vice versa? And I think that's actually one of the things that will turn me off, I think, as just a tabletop fan, or I'll find a game that looks incredible and the art design is incredible. And at the end of the day, you're looking at like, you know, a match X symbols to like, you know, X objective, and it just kind of like the floor falls out from underneath it.
Right.
So I kind of just look for those games where there's a justification on both ends between theme and mechanics.
Would you say, and I don't want to get too deep into Giga Robo quite yet, but, you know, it just fits in so well. Giga Robo, obviously very thematic, giant robots smashing each other in the city and things of this nature. Do you feel comfortable saying that you achieved that goal of bringing a good theme and a solid mechanic together?
Oh, yeah. I mean, at least I believe so. that's one of the reasons why I've gone so deep into it. Yeah, absolutely. I think that for me, kind of like the design pillar I want to work from is games that have a uncompromised theme. And actually, yeah, I guess touching back into exactly what I was saying before, where I want to design games that have this very much an uncompromised vision of their theme, and every mechanic is justified within that theme. Mm-hmm. Like, to feel like a complete immersive experience regarding, yeah, the topic or the genre. So I think I've done it with Giga Robo. I became such a giant tabletop fan, and I was a really big fan of giant robot and mecha like anime and manga to begin with. Mm-hmm. And I was looking to all of the like nooks and crannies I could with that genre, and saying like, well, obviously it needs this and it needs this, and how do we bring in these things that I feel like are essential to these shows and comics? Like, and how do you make it work within the total design?
Well, you know, let's just go there. We're there now. So Giga Robo, for those that aren't familiar with the game, can you give us the rundown?
Yeah. I'll try to tone down the autopilot convention voice. I always launch into, I'm so ready to. So Giga Robo is a card-driven miniatures game of giant anime robot combat. In the game, what you do is you select pilots and you select robots that each have decks of cards and different abilities. And what you're going to do is you're going to combine them all and make a personal build between them. Your own personal hand of cards between those decks. You select the abilities you want, and then you're going to use all of these attacks and these tactics and these big ultimate technique finishing moves. And you're going to be dueling opponents across a fully destructible city. And it hosts 2 to 4 players. And if we end up getting 2 expansions, it can actually open itself up to 6 total.
So you're constructing a mech. And so each game is going to be a little bit different because it's going to be a different mech each time. Is that right?
Yeah. I'm a really big fan of collectible card games. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of them, but I'm a fan of just the incredible depth they have to offer. And I'm personally really addicted to personalizing and customizing decks and things like that, and just, you know, being able to hit a table and you're like, this is mine, this is like a representation of my tastes and also the strategies I love, and it just feels like there's a sense of ownership. And I wanted to bring that to Giga Robo. So every pilot, for example, has a 10 card deck and they have 3 abilities. Every robot has a 30 card deck, 3 ultimate techniques and 6 abilities. And you're able to mix and match any robot on pilot, and you're able to mix and match all these cards between those that robot on pilot. So there's a ton of room for flexibility. And yeah, you can replay the game again and again and again using the same robot and same pilot, but still have wildly different builds.
And so you're designing that outside of the game, is that right? So you come to the game with your robot built, your pilot selected.
Yeah. It's
not like a deck builder where you're building it as part of the game.
No, yeah. When you hit the table, you kind of have your build ready. Though in the game we do have like intro builds pretty much prepared. But yeah, we have an entire breakdown for pilot and robot combinations that are very much new player friendly, so that your first time you can just immediately go to those, you pick the cards that it dictates, and then you can just hit the table and they have a like very distinct strategies already built in.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about the different pilots and the different robots that you have to pick from?
Absolutely. There are four pilots in the core set: Takashi Kato, Hadrian Korto, Noriko Nagare, and Dash. There are four human pilots. And then also on the Kickstarter right now, we have a bonus pilot that's free for all Kickstarter backers who is part of this alien race that plays with the game's overall narrative. They're called the Zoiders. His name is Madrakht Singh.
Those are great names, by the way.
Thank you so much. Takashi Kato is very much like a quintessential shonen anime hero. He's like a teenager who is like hot-headed and ready to fight. And he's, seeking revenge against the Zoiders who are abducting humans. And he is very much for players who like really aggressive, in-your-face strategies. He's really made so that you can go toe-to-toe, face-to-face with your opponent, and you don't have to ever back down. So one of the parts of the game is that the currency for the cards is your pilot's fighting spirit, and you gain that primarily through two ways. At the beginning of your turn, every pilot has a stat called Heart that dictates how much fighting spirit you can get, but every time you're hit by your opponent, you have Rage, which dictates a different value. So Takashi is full of Rage. So he's made so you're kind of inviting that punishment, but you don't have to ever worry about backing off of the attack. Hadrian Korto is for players who like more defensive strategies and also the concept of modifying your robot on the fly. He's this robot engineer and he's got this cybernetic arm, and playing into his entire backstory, he is able to do things where you can permanently remove cards from your hand in the game to gain permanent buffs for your robot. Like the idea that he's redirecting power, or if like a robot's limb is damaged to like shed weight, you just cut it off and you keep on fighting. He's very much focused on that thematically and mechanically. Noriko Nagare is really our most stat-wise balanced pilot in the game. She's really for players who like to have a sense of like they're able to basically modify the actual characteristics of their attacks. She has a really easy time adapting to opponents. And then also her abilities tie in with her backstory, where the idea is that she's supposed to be basically like Earth's greatest pilot, but she's so powerful, she kind of drives her machines into the ground. So for her, it's all about sacrificing your robot's like armor for different boosts in the game. Like just literally driving your robot to its very limits. Until like it might be crumbling apart, but it's getting this extreme performance. And then Dash is our kind of quintessential kid hero. Strategically, he is very, very much for players who like control decks and card games. He's got a lot of ways to counter opponents, a lot of ways to modify die roll results in the game. And he also has the most heart out of any pilot. I mean, because he is like the kid hero, and I felt like that was really necessary. And then for the robots in the core set, we've got Aizen, Chogoking, Dairaijin V, and Ogun. Aizen is this huge brawler robot. He's the slowest robot in the game, but his entire approach is that like if you get your opponent within range, he's really melee focused, and you're going to do a ton of damage. So it's kind of a lot about you have to plan your movements really carefully because he's so slow. But as soon as you get your opponent to a corner, like you're going to unleash a ton of damage. And he's got a lot of really brutal like debuffs. And then Chogoking Shogoking's very balanced between like melee and ranged attacks, but his kind of hook is that he has a microeconomy in the game with fire. So in the game, there are all these different elemental effects that can happen. And when you destroy buildings, they create these different impact tiles, which affect the board. So you can create these infernos and these big electrical storms we call arc hazards, as well as like craters and rubble. And for him, it's just, I probably shouldn't say him. I should stop assigning gender to a robot. It's a force of habit. So for Shogoking, usually fire is a bad thing for your opponents, but for him, he can convert fire and absorb it and redirect it into attacks. So he's very high risk and reward that way, though, because you're going to still be taking damage, but the more fire you pile up, you're going to have a higher damage output. And then you can also use it for different utilities and different defensive techniques as well. Then Dairaijin V is a little bit similar to Shogoking. His kind of in-game economy is based off of power surges, which are these electrical effects, which kind of same thing. Normally they're a negative, but Dairaijin V can convert them into specifically really high damage output and also increasing the amount of dice you can roll on attacks. Dairaijin V's kind of balance is that it's the fastest robot in the roster and the smallest robot in the roster. But once you get in there, like if you get close to your opponents and you're able to do these kind of hidden run attacks and these combos, you can build up these power surges over time and then unleash these kind of massive attacks. It's kind of unassuming at first until you build up to this level. And then Ogun is very focused on using the map against your opponent. His attacks are all about pushing and pulling and throwing your opponent into every single structure and hazard on the board you can find. He's got a great sense of board control and a sense of controlling distance with your opponent. So if you really like embracing the idea that like the map is your armory, essentially, Ogun is the choice for you.
So that's incredible. I mean, you have so much variety. How on earth do you balance all of that?
Through years of playtesting. So long. Yeah, it's funny. It's funny thinking about the very first time we ever played the game. So Steven Hammerschlag is the co-developer of GigaRobo, and the first time we sat down, I just had note cards and strips of paper, and like the very first thing, I was like, okay, this is how the game's gonna work. And we played like, you know, quotes card, and then it was like, oh, this broke the game. Okay, let's adjust that. And it was like, you know, it's bit by bit, but we've been doing private playtesting, obviously. Through development, we've also been doing a ton of public playtesting at game stores and then also at conventions. And then earlier this year, we ended a 6-month closed beta for the game that we called our test pilot program. And we've just been, it's been 2.5 years of development and just catching bugs, fixing balance issues, and just fine-tuning it more and more and more. And, you know, obviously the more people you get in the game and the more people who get their hands on the game, you're going to be getting more and more diverse ways of viewing the game and viewing what could be balanced. Because you never know like when somebody's going to exploit something in a way you never realized they could exploit it. Which is also one of the things I love about it, is that there's always people finding new combos and techniques that I didn't even inherently design or think about in the game. So it's really like awesome and rewarding on my end to see that happen. And even when people break the game, it's like, you know, what kind of devious mind that they have that they were able to, like, then they viewed their cards immediately like, oh, this is what I'm going to do. And it's a ton of fun.
So take us back as if we're a fly on the wall 2.5 years ago on that very first game with the cards. How different was the game back then than it is today? I mean, obviously visually, it's completely different, but
yeah,
gameplay wise,
completely different. So originally, there was a lot of mechanics that I felt very strongly needed to be part of the game. Like one thing I wanted to replicate, if you're familiar with it, is this idea like an anime where people have like basically energy blast attacks, where it's like going back and forth, like somebody shoots some beam and somebody else shoots a beam and they meet in the middle and it's like fighting back and forth, kind of like a tug of war before somebody overcomes their opponent.
Right.
So that was something I was like, this needs to be in the game. So originally, whenever you had a tie in the game with your die rolls, you went into a bidding war with Fighting Spirit, which I was like, this makes a lot of sense. There'll be a blind bid and you reveal it. But it like destroyed the game. It was every single time people would be stopping to like get into analysis paralysis, trying to figure out how much fighting spirit their opponent had. Because originally that was another thing, fighting spirit was hidden. It was vastly different. We had a completely different die system. The pace of the cards was completely different. It was a much longer game. And when we originally started, the robots had flight stands, and there's an entire way to do flight. But these were all things that we were cutting bit by bit just because they slowed down the game's pace and diluted it. And they weren't contributing enough to the theme. They were taking away more than they were contributing in that sense. From the very beginning of the game, the things that have stayed always true were that you were going to be building a hand of cards between a robot and a pilot, that it was going to be card and dice-based combat with miniatures, that there is destructible terrain from day one. That was something we felt really strongly about. And then also that the cards were going to be cycled through a cooldown meter, so that every time you play a card, they each have their own cooldown value, and that takes that many turns for that card to come back in your hand. So, because we never wanted to do a deck. We never wanted to have, you know, you blindly drawing from a deck, hoping to get to the strategy you wanted. We wanted it to be a thing like, this is a tight controlled strategy. It's all about timing. It's about more of a, it's always about a tactical decision rather than if you lucked into the card you wanted. But then, yeah, the original build was that plus a billion other things that made it completely bloated and incredibly hard to play.
Well, you know, it sounds like you struck on the magic of game design, which is cuts as much out as you can.
Oh yeah, yeah. Just cut the fat again and again and again and again and again. And then it's, you know, you gotta, in a way, like, you know, you like kill your heroes. It's very hard to like sacrifice the things you love and you want to make work so much, but at the end of the day, like, if it doesn't work, you just need to get rid of it and not look back.
Well, to that point, anything left on the cutting room floor that you're now kind of missing?
Yeah. I mean, things that are left on the cutting room floor that we're still kind of developing in the background to bring back in. It's funny, a lot of people have been asking about this in the Kickstarter, but originally one of the original concepts for the game was that it wasn't just called Giga Robo, it was called Giga Robo versus Giga Kaiju, and we were going to be having monsters in it as well, mainly because we wanted it to be a robot-focused game, and we wanted it to be based off of the manga and the anime I was mentioning before. And one of the quintessential, there's basically two versions of these fights you have in these shows and comics, is that it's either going to be robot on robot, or it's kind of like the Saturday morning monster of the week format, where you have the hero robot and every week somebody sends a new monster for them to defeat, right? And we kind of wanted to tie that in, but then we decided to narrow our focus more to just the robot versus robot combat and kind of those iterations of these comics and cartoons. But that's something I would love to bring back in at some point. I'm a diehard, lifelong Godzilla fan and Gamera fan, so it's something very near and dear. Also, we ended up cutting it, but we really want to, at some point, it would be great to do for an expansion, is we wanted to do different size classes of robots. So right now in the core set and the expansions, each robot takes up a single hex, and we want to do these robots that are even bigger. They're taking up like 3 or 4 hexes at a time, and create these kind of handicap modes where you can have multiple robots fighting off against one gigantic robot, like an overpowered kind of boss character. So those were two things that I would love to revisit in expansions if we're lucky enough to get there.
Well, now I have to ask, I mean, this is, as you said, your first game, first project on Kickstarter. It's incredibly ambitious, right? I mean, you got miniatures, you got tons of, you know, lots of intricacy in the mechanics and the game itself. At any point, and you can be honest, at any point did you ever feel like, man, I just bit off way more than I can chew?
I actually, not to sound like pompous, I actually have never felt that way, but I've felt something very similar, and that I've like looked and been like, man, it would have been way smarter to just like design a tiny card game. But like, I never felt like it was too much, because like, this is the thing I wanted to make from day one. Like, even before, when I started wanting to get into the game design, I didn't necessarily immediately look and say like, what isn't on the market or anything like that. I don't think it was that transparent, but I know that at the time I was like, I really want a gaming experience that allows me to kind of inhabit these robots from the, like, you know, the media I love from like the 70s and the 80s, like the big, colorful, big, bold, black lined, like, you know, extremely vibrant super robots. mm-hmm. and stuff like Mazinger Z and things like that that were just like larger than life. And I just wanted that experience. And then it just ended up being like, well, this is the thing I should do. But no, yeah, I don't think I've ever actually felt like it was too much. It's always just felt like a puzzle that I needed to, you know, just crack in terms of getting right. Though I have kind of joked about, like, I mean, fully aware, every single game designer I've ever met who's been published or established has always given the recommendation of like, you should really start with a small game. Like, you know, like maybe like a small card game, something that's like, you know, a very small deck, or maybe at most you're doing cards and some punch board. And I don't know. I just wanted to dive in.
Well, kudos to you. You know, go Thanks. Big or go home. Thanks. Good job. Well, let's talk more about Kickstarter. You've been on for what, about 2 weeks now?
Yeah, just about.
Yeah. How are things going?
Things are going really well. We have a $45,000 goal. We're at, right at the moment of us recording, we're at $43,654, and we still have 21 days to go. So we're right at the edge of funding and starting to go into stretch goals.
Right. Yeah. Right. That's really exciting. What do you attribute that success so far to?
Well, first of all, I to be honest, I wasn't expecting it, but our first day was really phenomenal. Within the first like 8 hours, we went up 17 grand.
Wow.
Which I was completely shocked at. I was not expecting it. I thought, you know, in the beginning, like, oh, it'll be a slow burn. People will discover it. And there's going to also be other people like myself starting out who are like wanted this experience in a game, and specifically in a tabletop game. And like, when they learn about it, they'll join in and like, you know, if we're lucky, we'll fund. And I was like very fully prepared. Like I've seen, you know, there are so many Kickstarters that don't fund, or they'll end their campaigns halfway and then they relaunch a couple months later and they knock it out of the park, right? Because they've just, right. they've gained their audience. And I was fully prepared to do that. I mean, to be completely honest, I wasn't prepared for this to happen. So I don't know, actually. I think probably the biggest reason for our success so far was definitely got great responses. I did a front page ad on BoardGameGeek for our launch day that brought in a lot of people, but I think it was actually just people discovering it on Kickstarter. I think the biggest source of people finding the game were just people who were going into the tabletop game section of Kickstarter that day. And then kind of over the course of the first few days, we've had some diehard supporters who have come out and they've been branching out and trying to support the game in their own ways and encouraging the rest of the community, which has just been completely awesome. And
yeah.
So incredibly flattering. And I don't know. I mean, my favorite thing about this hobby is how inclusive it can be. The feeling of like, you know, you push this, it's like pushing your baby out into the world and then everybody wants it to succeed, seemingly. Well, not everybody, but you know, a lot of people want it to succeed and are really trying their hardest to help you bring it to fruition.
Well, so what's next after the campaign's up?
I think I'm going to try to relax for the first time in many years. And then, the first thing is that, I mean, depending on stretch goals, a lot of the art is already created. So if we have a stretch goal, so we can have every card in the game have its own unique piece of art. And if we hit that, that will be immediately, we already have all of our commissions set. We know exactly what the poses are for the cards and the compositions. So immediately contacting artists for that. Specifically our lead artist, Mark Henry Bustamante, and then our lead sculptor, Matt Mullen, contacting him to complete the additional sculpts. And a lot of the materials, I would say, like in terms of graphic design, are probably 90% there already with our components. The main thing that we need to refine is our rulebook. We've been planning graphical upgrades to it and doing examples for every single step of the game, which we still need to implement, and then also doing a quick play rulebook. Which I love that. I mean, Fantasy Flight does that for everything, and it's such a good idea. So we wanted to implement that as well. So I think those are going to be the first things we start working on. Also, I think putting the miniatures directly into production, because we have a tier on the Kickstarter where you can have them pre-painted, and we want to make sure nothing's going to get slowed down. So first thing we do is put miniatures in production, have them pre-painted as we're finalizing the last of the graphic assets. I think that's the next step.
Yeah. Well, a lot to do.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. but nothing too overwhelming.
That's good.
Yeah.
A big group of listeners on your Tables on Fire are aspiring game designers. They're perhaps planning their first Kickstarter project, hoping to someday be in your shoes. What advice do you have for them?
Oh, man. so many things. I would say the biggest thing, and I'm sure this is, I know it's been echoed a billion times, is that, playtest, put your game into other people's hands, do blind playtests, whatever you can, just get into as many people's hands as possible, and then let them destroy your game. Let them show you how broken your game is, even though you love it with your heart and soul. And, nobody can say anything bad about your baby. But guess what? Your baby's broke and you just have to accept it. And, you just got to move on forward. That would probably be the biggest thing, is just, it's no joke. Playtest as much as possible, because somebody will break your game and you want them to break it before it's released, because you don't want to release a game that's just ruined by one small thing you missed. Also, I think just listen to the community. Never be too proud in this regard. Everybody has, obviously you can't please everybody, but there are so many passionate and intelligent people out there who want to help you make your game the best it can be. So listen to everybody you can. And I think the last thing would probably be, from day one, think about the price of your game. Think about what your MSRP is going to be. Learn what MSRP is. Learn how you calculate MSRP. Do all of these things. And know what your component constraints are, because you don't want to get to the point where you've developed your dream project and then you realize that the only way for you to, and not necessarily profit, just like the only way you're able to make it an actual functional retail product is like to sell it for $300. It's going to be heartbreaking, and you're going to be so invested into it at that point. And you're going to have to scale it back. I think that was one thing that held me up, is that, at least starting out, was that I would be seeing all these games that I adored from large publishers and thinking like, oh, we could just match this, But then the first thing you find out is that the reason why they can price their games that way is because they've got a really large print run. And, starting out, you're not going to be able to do like a 5,000 or more unit print run. Like, you're not going to be able to bring the price of your game down that far. So you have to think about doing a smaller print run, and how do you make the most out of your budget while still making it appealing when it's on a shelf, next to all of these larger games from larger publishers. Not to say larger games, all these games from larger publishers.
Right. Good advice.
Thanks.
Alex, it is time for me to come clean with you.
Yes.
And tell you that this whole podcast is a big ruse. The real reason that I brought you here today is not to talk about Giga Robo, but it's to play the game design challenge.
Okay. Okay, I'm ready. Let's do this. Is my cred going to be just destroyed right now?
Well, we'll see. Well, that's up to you and only you.
Oh, man.
So here's how this works. I'm going to pick a random game theme. I'm going to give that to you. You're going to chew it over, think out loud, and then pitch back to me what that game might be.
Okay.
All right, you up for that?
I will try my best.
Oh, I'm confident. Come on, you created Giga Robo. You got this.
It's true. It only took 2.5 years to make.
And you have, 2.5 minutes to do this?
This is
no
perfect.
Problem.
No problem. I'm ready.
Okay.
I was born for this moment.
Here we go. The theme is giant leprechauns.
Say giant leprechauns?
Giant leprechauns.
Giant
That's
leprechauns. Okay. Giant leprechaun game. So I feel like we got to identify what is essential to this right now. What are leprechauns about? So leprechauns, obviously, I'm really hoping I'm not going to accidentally say some completely stereotyped thing right now. I'm going to try my best. Okay, so let's think. So,
you're not in Boston. You're okay.
It's true. But I will be in Boston again someday. So leprechauns, we always got Pot of Gold. We've got Granting Wishes. Obviously, we got all the green. I guess that's less important. So I think we're going to have to focus on the essentials of a leprechaun are that they're promising a pot of gold, right? Isn't that the, I'm sure there's a way darker, like grim fairy tale style, like source to the myth of leprechauns somewhere that I really hope exists so I could tap into it. But let's just stick with that right now. Okay.
Okay.
Pot of gold.
Family friendly. That's fine.
Family friendly. Leprechauns, pot of gold. So I feel like the first thing is that you're trying to decipher you're going to find this pot of gold. How are you going to, okay. This is kind of completely asinine. So what I'm immediately imagining is, why is there going to be a giant leprechaun? Well, you have to overtake them somehow. You have to discover, you have to decipher their secrets. Where are they keeping their gold? You, okay, an industrious adventurer, have found the true legend of the leprechauns. Let's pretend this is this Grimm Brothers, like, okay, fairy tale, that leprechauns are actually these, like, towering, horrible monstrosities. They're like dragons in Dungeons and Dragons, and they're like, you know, they're hoarding all their gold, but you know, they'll let it free to the person who can defeat them, essentially. So I'm thinking kind of like, I'm directly going to violence, unfortunately, but let's say the leprechauns are like these giant, like, colossal creatures, and the board is essentially, this is kind of like thinking about the video game Shadow of Colossus also. You as an industrious adventurer need to scale the leprechauns in order to find their weak points and defeat them in order to secure their pot of gold. But I feel like is there something about, oh man, this is breaking my brain right now. this has made me realize I don't know much about leprechauns. I feel like I'm culturally bankrupt. But this is what I've got. I've got the board is simulating you scaling this gigantic leprechaun.
Okay.
So that you can either seek combat or perhaps beat it in a game of wits. I guess you're reaching its head. I don't know what's happening. And then you'll somehow get it to give it the goods. Where's the gold?
Okay.
That's what I got.
So each player is racing to, the first one to either defeat the leprechaun in some manner is the winner. Is that how it kind of plays out?
I'm thinking like you'd be working with a couple of different mechanics. The first thing is that there'd have to be something for the difficulty of scaling the terrain that is the leprechaun's green costume, I guess. So it's like, and obviously there has to be different, like, you know, terrain rules for its clothes. Like, you know, its shoes are probably going to be easy to climb because it's got shoelaces. But like once you get up to its slacks, I mean, there's not much to grab onto. That's just going to require raw dexterity. So you're going hand over hand there. So I feel like part of it will be, it's kind of like a mountain climbing simulator. So you've got that part. There's different phases of the gameplay. Yeah. So there's,
of course,
that.
Right.
And then,
yeah, at some point, the giant leprechaun is going to be aware that you're scaling it.
Yeah.
So he's going to try and stop you.
Yeah, he's going to try to stop you. So there's going to be some dexterity. And I feel like that's where the combat would really shine. Is that, like, it's about navigating really difficult terrain while also, you know, defending yourself at the same time. Not only against the leprechaun, but against all of the other adventurers who are trying to scale the leprechaun. Because I feel like this is a PvP kind of situation we're entering into. So yeah, maybe different phases of gameplay. And then when you get to the top of it, I feel like it's really sad that you'd like be trying to kill a leprechaun at the end of the day. I feel like there needs to be some kind of more peaceful end. Like three phases of the gameplay. Like you have like terrain, you're trying to climb the leprechaun, you're trying to kind of defend yourself, and there's a combat phase there. And then I feel like at the end there has to be some final challenge that's not directly, maybe not directly conflict based. I don't know what that is though.
I like your idea of you know, challenge game of wits or something.
Yeah. Feel like,
I don't know how you do that mechanically.
Neither do I right now. But there's got to be some way. Maybe there's like an entire event deck. Maybe it's just like a bunch of like sub-challenges. Maybe you like duck away from the leprechaun's hand and you fall into a wrinkle of clothing and you find like an older adventurer who's been stuck there his entire life and he, like, you could beseech him for advice on how to win the gold.
Oh, I like it.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, so you could kind of mix in some storytelling aspects. So it's a little bit of role playing, a little bit of just dexterity gameplay.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like at this point there should probably be an entire like village of people who have just given up on their quests, but they can't descend from the leprechaun and they're just living in its clothes.
They're just stuck.
Yeah, they're
in
just
the pocket
there. And you have to make peace with them. You have to be accepted. This might be the worst or best game ever designed.
Yeah. It's really hard to tell.
It's hard to tell.
It all depends on how awesome the miniatures are, let's be honest.
Of course, yes. Yes, that is what it's all about at the end of the day. How awesome are the miniatures? And also, there, I mean, oh, if there's some kind of like physical way to have them like vertically scaling. So it's not you're not just looking at a flat board. You're actually looking at like one giant.
There's like some fish twine that is connected to the miniature that you're like actually pulling it up the leprechaun.
I feel like anything that brings it to more of like the space of like you're playing with toys is probably the best idea. Like just for the sheer fun. You could probably, and the leprechaun could probably be made out of like that vacuum formed plastic, kind of like Fireball Island. I think that's the way to do it.
Like you were saying, you wouldn't want this game to cost $300. So
no,
I don't know.
No.
I think we just crossed that line. Especially if there's 30 villagers in his pocket.
All with full miniatures.
Right, of course. All individually crafted.
Individually crafted. That is it.
Okay. Oh, Alex, well done.
Oh, man.
Okay, I'm expecting next year at Gen Con to demo this game. So just shoot me an email as soon as it's ready.
I will. And I will tell you the title of it already is Shin Giga Robo Giga Leprechaun Go. That is the title. I'm playing on Ash Barker's guess for what the sequels to Giga Robo would be played. But yes, Giga Leprechaun Go.
Giga Leprechaun Go. I love it. It's the perfect expansion, the obvious expansion to Giga Robo.
The only one that makes sense.
Oh, Alex, it's been a real pleasure speaking with you today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, and best of luck with the rest of the campaign.
Thank you so much.
Well, that was Alex Cheng, the founder of Cardboard Dynamo and the designer of Giga Robo, currently on Kickstarter. This episode of Your Tables on Fire has been brought to you by Word Domination. If you have plans to take over the world, you can do it just by spelling. Check out Word Domination at www.worddomination.net. Thanks for tuning in to Your Tables on Fire. You can follow us on Twitter at TableFire. And also check out our website for show notes and other details, www.yourtablesonfire.com. We're on iTunes, Google Play, and of course BoardGameGeek. Hit us up on any of those websites and give us a review. We'd love to hear what you think. Well, until next time, go light it up.